Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Hi, welcome everyone to the Grow Business podcast. Today, I'm speaking with David J. Greer. David, how are you today?
I am fantastic. Having a great day here.
Having a great day. Whereabouts are you in the world?
I'm in Vancouver, BC, Canada.
Ah, right. What's the weather like? This is the weather part of the chat.
Well, it's spring and it's not a bad day. The sun has started to come out and the cherry blossoms are in full flow here in Vancouver and all the trees are starting to green up. So it's really beautiful, really pretty springtime right now.
Oh, that's lovely. I can see the sun streaming in through your window there for those people who obviously are just imagining this at the moment. So it's really great to have you on the podcast. Thank you for thanks for chatting to me. For those people who don't know who you are, who haven't had any experience, haven't seen your website, haven't spoken with you, could you give everyone just a little bit of a sort of annotated overview of who you are and what you get up to?
Sure. I'm a 40 plus year entrepreneur. Yep. For the last close to a decade, I've been an entrepreneurial coach and a facilitator for strategic planning for entrepreneurs and for their teams. And I focus on helping entrepreneurs who are stuck in their business or who want to grow their business faster. And I especially focus on entrepreneurs who struggle with alcoholism or addiction. I'm an alcoholic who's been just celebrated 15 years of sobriety. Nice. And I think there's some special new, you know, there's extra difficulties in being an entrepreneur and being in recovery. It's just the nature of being an entrepreneur and running a business. So, you know, I've both run businesses as an active alcoholic and I've run them in recovery. So, you know, that's something different that I bring to the table.
Yeah, sure. And so I imagine, you know, I guess just as a segue from that then too, right at the start of our chat, how, you know, I know there's probably, you know, no real, you know, accurate way or proper way to say how many people struggle generally, especially at a very high level in their business. Like, you know, I mean, I do, everybody running a business or, you know, entrepreneurs, people in executive positions, there's all sorts of different stresses and things that people struggle with. But in your experience, it's in terms of how many people who use you know, things like drinking or, you know, drugs or sort of whatever to actually help them cope you know, with those sort of stresses. Like, what do you find with your work?
I've done quite a bit of research. I've talked to actually some of the researchers who do this, and again, you know, I'm a super high-performing alcoholic, and I certainly know other entrepreneurs who are super high-performing recovering alcoholics as well. And, like, we just don't generally – there's still so much stigma with alcoholism. We don't, like, answer surveys, honestly. And so the researchers just say because of that bias, they don't really have a number separately for entrepreneurs. Mm. But here's what I can tell you. Is generally around the world or in the Western world, 10% of the population are alcoholics. Mm. There's a good chance one of them is an alcoholic or addict. Mm. You know, there's some anecdotal reason to think that, you know, as entrepreneurs and the high stresses that we take on, it's not going to be lower. Let's put it that way. And probably going to be a higher percentage, but that's still a lot of people. And then another rule of thumb is only, again, in the general adult population, only about 10% of people who are alcoholics will in turn try and do anything about their disease. Mm. And it is a mental health disease, right? It is categorized as a mental health disease, you know, alcohol use disorder or substance use disorder. And that's sad. So part of my mission is to raise awareness that, there, there is a lot of stigma, but there, you have a mental health disease. It's not that you're morally bankrupt or you need to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. I mean, it's the most powerful drug on the planet, and yet it's completely social, you know, it's completely accepted. If in the United States someone tried to take alcohol and get it approved with the FDA as a drug, it would never ever be allowed.
It's amazing, isn't it? How things get normalized. Yeah, how things get normalized throughout the, you know, the decades or centuries, I suppose you could say too. You know, it's a part of culture, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, the other half of my message to entrepreneurs, especially, is there's hope. Like if a drunk like me can get sober, then I promise you, you can get sober. But the one thing I believe deeply is you can't do it alone. And it's a disease of isolation, and you know, turning away from others and from help. And you know, we all have to reach some point where, I mean, I was in denial for over 20 years as a daily drinker, but I wasn't an alcoholic because for a whole bunch of reasons. So I mean, we can dig deeper into that, but I also want to help your audience. With other things that I spend a lot of time on in growing their business, especially since that's the title of your podcast.
Well, it's growing your business.
Maybe we can weave those things together.
Well, I should say too that as the title of the podcast sort of started and then grew, so to speak, too, I realized that Grow Your Business is also your business in terms of what makes your money and your life for a lot of people, but it's also what your business is, like what do you do, who you are. It's all that too. So those things, as far as I'm concerned, as I'm through my own experience too, is they're kind of very much interwoven. So I think it's very important. I think these sort of stories are integral to people's business too, which just leads me to next question too, which is that how do you find having that sort of area of speciality helps you help people who don't have those sort of issues too? How does that inform your thinking?
Sure. I mean, because, you know, I only work with high performing people. Like that's just the kind of people that I attract and that I want to work with, you know, and I've got the energy level to match them. Like, you know, an interesting question for an entrepreneur is like, why do you want to grow your business? Like, you know, do you have the life that you want? You know, does the business have you pinned to the ground? Like, have you got the tiger by the tail, or is it the other way around? And are you choosing? And, you know, I think that that is something as we grow our business, it's super easy to lose sight of that. And to just become all encompassed. And as you said, like a lot of who we are as a human being gets wrapped up in the business and wrapped up in our ego, which isn't necessarily good for us. So for example, I use a model from my first coach that I worked with for 9 years, Coach Kevin Lawrence, who I think is a brilliant entrepreneur, from his book, Your Oxygen Mask First. And he says, let's look at your life in three ways. So first of all, we're going to look at like your business and what you want to do about your business. And then here's your life, which is your relationships and your family. And what I find with high performing individuals and especially entrepreneurs is they're very passionate about both of those things. But what happens is that we squeeze ourselves out in the middle. Right. And so, Coach Kevin asks us to look at this third category, which is self. And like so if you're looking at your year and what you want your plan to be, it's like, what's your passion ratio, which I consider to be like time times energy. Like, what's your passion ratio for the business? What's it for yourself? And what's it for life? And if you want it to be 80, 10, 10, that's okay. I mean, I'm just asking you to make a conscious choice for that, and not to make yourself be zero. Because ultimately, if we put everything into our business and into our life, at the end of the beat, we will burn out, crash. I mean, we see it as side effects like addictions and alcoholism. We see it as like getting really sick. Like the universe will do something to tell you, right? But I'm saying, you know, like for me, I'm a passionate sailor. So like when I need renewal, when I need something that's just for me, is sometimes like I just go out solo sailing. I mean, it's great with my wife too, and then I get some life stuff and we get some connection that way, but I'm okay just going out for a couple of weeks by myself and sailing the West Coast here in Canada. And it builds my resiliency and it causes me to reset and, you know, slows me down. And also when I'm sailing, like I have very little control. We have, you know, entrepreneurs, high-performing individuals and entrepreneurs in particular think that they have way more control of things than they actually do. Yeah. You know, we only really control about 1%. You know, we the things I believe all I have control of is how I react to an event. And I actually don't, I try not to react. I try and respond. And what's the next right step? I mean, yes, I have plans and yes, I know where I want to go, but really all I've got is my next step. And that's all I have control over. You know, and anyways, so when I get in a sailboat, you know what? The wind's in control. The wave's in control. The universe is in control. Like I can choose where I want to go, but if conditions aren't right, I might not even get there. And I, you know, some strings to pull on how much sail is out and how much and what direction. And that's it. Like, but everything, it really reminds me I'm not in control, right? The universe is in control and I just get to adjust my sails to what's happening and I can make it as easy or as hard for me as I want.
Yeah. Or I can stay at the dock. Yeah, I do like those metaphors. I have to say, I was reading on your website, and you've got that book, Your Wind in Your Sails too. Is that right? That's the correct title?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that is correct.
Yeah, so that's I do like those metaphors very much, and I think that's very apt. The idea. I was going to actually ask what you're in that series of metaphors. If you're going to tack into the wind, like what? How would you say? How would you translate that to that sort of process in sailing to something in business or in life, you know, in terms of like a how that relates to life? Because I was thinking, like, I'm not a sailor, but I do. I've always been fascinated. Like, I've been sailing, but I'm not a sailor, but I've always been fascinated about the idea of tacking into the wind, utilizing it. So you could probably speak more to that, like how that. So
if you can go downwind, you can go a lot faster.
Yeah.
Than if you actually are trying to go into the wind. Your expertise is marketing. So I think that the sailing analogy has got kind of the deepest resonance in marketing, which is, you know, you can choose to like go against a market or try and convince a market of something that they're not completely convinced of. And sometimes in innovative new companies, it's like worth doing that. But I think a lot of growing a business successfully is figuring out like which way is the wind blowing in your market. And then how do you tie into that in a way that it differentiates from your competitors, but which goes with the flow of where the market's going. And then sometimes like your market's going to run out. And a lot of my background is technology. So tech cycles go very fast and you may come up with a product, but it may only, you know, the market may absorb those kinds of products over a 2 to 4 year period. And like, you'll have sustained revenues, but you won't be able to grow more because like the market, it's kind of the market's figured out and it's moved to the next technical thing, which is really, that's where the tacking comes, which is when is your market going to run out and when are you going to go pursue another market? Or, you know, like you've got your sales set and you're doing really well in this market. So where's another place you could be where similarly the wind is blowing in a nice direction, you know, and it's warm and it's comfortable. And how could you stick your hand into that like cash stream and extract your part of it?
Yeah. And then the destination too, I guess, like how quickly is the wind going to get you to the destination you want to go to as well, I guess.
Yeah. And so I do a lot of work with strategic planning. And the process I use is I ask entrepreneurs to pause once every quarter, which is 13 weeks. So go 13 weeks with the plan, pause, see how you're doing, and then plan the next 13 weeks. And the reason for that is most entrepreneurs get totally, especially when the business becomes more and more successful, they get entrenched in the next fire, the next, like, the next employee, the next thing, the next trade show, the next event. And they're basically looking down the path only far enough to, like, not step on a big rock, you know, and they're looking 10 feet ahead. And if you don't pause every quarter and look up, like, maybe you're on a path that's just going in a circle.
Mm.
Like, or you were planning to go climb a mountain in North America, whereas, you know, really you're aiming to go climb a mountain in Nepal. Are you still aiming for the right destination? And if you don't pause and do this strategic work, so I call it working on the business instead of in the business.
Mm.
Right. And it's really hard. Like, most entrepreneurs get totally consumed by their business and it's super hard for them to step back. You know, part of my role as a coach is to just even, you know, I do one-on-one coaching, which is typically structured like 2 calls a month. And sometimes it's just those calls to, like, just ask them, like, can you pause and tell me, like, where are you aiming the business this year? Like, you know, and have you stopped and actually checked? Are you still aiming for the place you thought you were aiming for?
Mm.
Or has the data changed and, or you haven't noticed or you haven't been paying attention?
Yeah.
And sometimes my work is just to get them to pause long enough to actually look at that they're on the, you know, they're on the path that they want to be on and they're aiming for the destination that they want to aim for.
And I guess
that's really easy to get lost in the day to day.
Yeah. Is it true to say as well, or I guess, you know, how often does something like this happen where people are aiming for their destination, but then they realize because of that process that you've got to be able to pause that the destination is not quite right. Even, you know, that it's
right.
It's like slightly, maybe not a wholesale change, but a little shift. You know, it might be like the island over.
So what I coach entrepreneurs who involve me in their strategic planning is come up with a short list of goals, like 4 or 5 for a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Go like hell for 13 weeks against those goals, and either you succeed or you don't. And then, you know, at 13 weeks is long enough to get serious shit done, but it's short enough that if you pause and look, you can course correct.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. That island is actually 100 miles wide and we were aiming for the south end of it, but now we realize that all the gold is actually on the north end of it and we have to course adjust to the north end.
Mm.
And we still got lots of runway to get us, you know, we have enough time to get there. But if you don't take these pauses and evaluate your successes and failures, then it's really easy to miss that. That's why a year goes by very fast, especially, you know, I consider high growth anything probably above 15 or 20% year over year revenue growth.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like that's, and so, you know, if you have 1 or 2% revenue growth, maybe you can plan once a year, because things don't change that much. But if you're 10, 15, 20% revenue growth, like your whole pace is moving way faster. And so you need to plan. You need to take the pauses more often because you're running at a much, much higher speed.
Mm.
And so it also means you're going to get off course a lot faster because you're going a lot faster.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And then like you were saying before, I mean, like the, these are the sort of things that, I guess people who in business should obviously think about, but people who aren't sailors, you know, don't think about them. But that idea, just returning to that metaphor again about the wind takes you a certain way, and then you have to, like you were saying before, you have to respond to it because you can't really. Is it true to say you can't really react to it? You really have to respond to it. Is that right?
And, well, yeah, you have to respond. I mean, there, you know, you have a lot of, I think also entrepreneurs forget the choices that they have. Like, you know, if you're close to an island, but at the wrong end of it, you can drop your anchor and rest in a bay and wait for the wind to change.
Mm.
Like, again, it's, or, you know, you could think, oh, I have to go to the other end of the island. That's where the wind's coming from. So I'm going to have to beat my brains out, because that angle of attack in a sailboat is called beating,
right,
for a good reason, because you take a beating. But you have other options. You know, what would happen if you paused and just waited? Looked at the weather, you know, like you could do things like look at the weather forecast and see if this is going to last for, you know, if it's only going to last for the rest of the afternoon. Then you could pause and do something. I mean, one of the chapters in my book, I actually start with a story about when my wife, Carolee, and I forgot to check the forecast before we left. And like how much grief that caused, especially it was early on in our sailing career, and it really scared my wife, and it really, you know, impacted her comfort on the boat for a long time.
Mm.
And, you know, if I just listened to the forecast and knew what was coming, then we would have had much less sail up. We wouldn't have been surprised. We would have been much better prepared.
Mm.
Right. And that's kind of part of this planning. Like you can't plan for everything, and weather sometimes weather forecasts are wrong, but if you don't do any planning, then you're just kind of going to get tossed around by the wind and waves because you weren't expecting them.
You get completely stranded. I remember actually when I was a kid, I had this very distinct memory when I was probably about, I was born in a place called Mount Isa, which is up in the north of Queensland. And we were on this trip when I was probably about 4 or 5, and we went out to the, a coral reef, and there was on this little island, which was a reasonable sized little island. But then what actually happened was we got stranded, and I had this distinct memory of the island actually literally becoming, it got engulfed by the sea, because the people who were organizing the trip didn't look at the weather, and all of a sudden the island was literally engulfed, and it was about, I think it was probably about 10 meters across left in the island. Mm-hmm. And they saved us, like they came and actually, you know, in like a speedboat and got us. But I always remember that as this this very simple sort of memory I have of being on the sea and this happening, sort of seemingly magically got swallowed up. But you know, I think all those, like I love all those metaphors that you've sort of weaved like from your experience as a sailor. So in that. I'm just sort of moving on to culture, say in a business too. Like you, how would you say, like in a, you know, in lead this on into another sort of area too? But how to use culture to drive performance, I guess too, and how that works in with entrepreneurs in the business. Like how does that?
So my personal belief is to drive really high performance, you need to focus consciously on culture. So every company has a culture.
Mm.
Typically, a company has the culture of the founder and maybe the founder and the first couple key employees.
Yep.
So I see culture is more an act of discovery, like rather than a effort of, you know, trying to, you know, being nice people. Like there's a lot of great companies who have been built that are built by assholes, and like they have an asshole culture, but it's okay. If everybody is an asshole, they get along, you know, but if you don't fit that mold, you're not going to do too well there. And so again, I don't think it's, you have to be altruistic. I think you have to be, you know, realistic about what your color is and what your culture is. And I have a few exercises that come from Jim Collins and Good to Great. Like, none of this stuff is, you know, invented from scratch, right? We have a lot of resources to draw from. And my belief is that culture drives behaviors. Like culture is just a way of really describing how people behave.
Mm.
And in my experience, you know, if you're hiring people, it's virtually impossible to change someone's behavior. I mean, or it's so much work, it's just not worth it, because our behaviors, you know, are defined by our early childhood family of origin, our early mentors, teachers, sports coaches. So that gets baked in really deep.
Early too, would you say?
Yeah, and very early. For most of us, it's before five.
Yep.
So, you know, I really coach people around hire for your culture first and skills second. So people tend to do skills, right? Okay, I need a computer programmer. They need to know Perl, or they need to know PHP, and they need to have this framework and that framework, and they need to be able to demonstrate, you know, this dexterity with algorithms and data, because I come from that background. So, great. But I mean, are they a cultural fit? Like, because if they can do the stuff, but they, you know, if you're a really team-oriented organization, a very people-oriented organization, and you expect people to be able to interact and solve their own problems, well, a brilliant computer programmer who you kind of close the door and feed mushrooms and pizzas under the door, and I can joke about it because I've been that guy at times.
I relate to that, yes.
You know, that is probably not going to fit in well. And in fact, it's going to cause more problems than they solve. So we, you know, I believe you also want to hire, like, A's want to hire double A's, and double A's want to hire triple A's, because if A's hire B's, they hire C's, and pretty soon you have Z's, and or Z, we would say in Canadian. You know, like, nothing's getting done. But the challenge is when we get a performer, but they don't fit in with the culture. You know, they get things super lot done, but they do it, you know, by standing on other people's shoulders and shoving them down, or they do it by cutting corners everywhere, so no one can follow up with what they did because they never documented anything. So, you know, and then they go on holidays and, like, no one can actually figure out product delivery because nothing's documented. So we want to hire for culture first and skills second. I mean, you still are going to have a skills baseline for certain positions, right? Mm. I mean, if you need an experienced computer programmer, developer, I mean, that's what you need, but make sure that they're going to fit into your culture first. And I believe that we experience and communicate about culture by telling stories. Like, mm-hmm. I really encourage teams to, like, at their weekly meeting, can you share one win for a team member, or maybe challenge the group, you know, share a win about a team member and a core value it demonstrated.
Mm.
So we drive culture through stories, and then we drive business through data.
Mm.
And as an entrepreneur, I know I've been guilty of, like, you know, hearing the last salesman say that, you know, I didn't get that sale because the product didn't have X, Y, and Z. Right. And maybe that's true, but that's just one anecdotal story, and it happens to be the most recent one that I heard. What's the data about that? Like, are you losing a lot of sales about that? I mean, you know, what
the specifics, specific data.
Hmm. Yeah, specific data. So I do a lot of work around KPIs, key productivity indicators. Like, what are the key numbers that are driving the success of your business? And let's go focus on those. And again, financial metrics, which are always trailing. But again, like, you know, it's amazing how many entrepreneurs who I know or I've worked with who keep trying to grow the top line without really mechanically, you know, focusing on the bottom line. It's like, yes, but are you deriving the profit from every increase, every dollar of revenue increase? Are you getting the profit margin you're expecting?
So when you actually, just a quick question there too, like, when you've got culture in a business, where do you feel that when you've got a group of people, however many people they are, and you've got meetings, and when people actually come together, that the element of relatability, you know, from one person to another, how important do you find that is? I know it sort of seems like a small point, but to me, when there's any group of people, is like how well individuals relate to each other. And I guess where the either like team leader or the entrepreneur, if it, you know, who's running the meeting or sort of steering things, so to speak, like the actual captain on the ship is steering things, and how well people relate to each other overall? Where does that fit in terms of importance in this whole scheme of things?
I think it's really important, but again, it's driven by the entrepreneur. Mm. And if the entrepreneur is not really open to teamwork, open to delegation, like I see this a lot where you get owner founders who start a business and by necessity, they grow every single aspect of the business. So mm. now you're doing like a couple million a year in revenue, right? And it's time for the entrepreneur to let go of some of these things because they can't control all of it anymore because it's got too big, but they think their way is the only way because they've figured it all out in order to get where they are.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so, you know, sometimes people hire me because their senior executive team never listens to them. And the challenge isn't that they never listen to them. It's that they, you know, the entrepreneur delegates to a senior team leader and then snatches back and tells them how to do it or berates them for not doing it his way. Or, you know, like they haven't truly delegated and trusted the person. So some of the work that I do is actually trust building. And I recently, for facilitation I did last week, I actually did an extra exercise the night before with the two founders and their two first reports who form the core team. And we did a trust exercise for 2.5 hours, sharing our life stories with each other. It's called the Lifeline exercise. People could just look it up if you use an internet search engine. And it's basically you just have a graph which has, you know, kind of plus 10 to minus 10 of how satisfied or fulfilled you were in your life and time, you know, from zero to however old you are. And you do a personal line and you do a school work line. And it's, you know, some people I know, it hasn't happened to me, but I talked to other coaches who've done the Lifeline with people who worked together for 20 years and they do the Lifeline exercise. And there are 5 things about someone they've worked with for 20 years that they had no idea about. Mm. Right. And the exercise, you can only do it, you know, it's an exercise that can be very vulnerable. So it's just really to the level that people are comfortable sharing with each other.
Mm. Yeah. Right. I mean, like trust is, I would imagine, like just, you know, for me, it, you know, trust is kind of at the heart of everything too. But it, because I suppose from my perspective, it's almost like the thing that facilitates opening or closing doors too, really, isn't it? Like, you know, to be able to go, because you could be a great communicator, like I remember talking about it. There's a person who's a great communicator, but you know, are they good at facilitating, you know, people being relatable to each other? Because it's okay saying on one level, you know, be relatable or try to be more relatable to this other person. But if you don't, if the person, you know, who's the team leader, the captain or whatever, doesn't help that process, like to open that door and then to trust other people to do the right thing, you got to like open that door at some point, don't you? You
know, well, and the entrepreneur themselves have to be open.
Yes.
Like that, right? Like that has to start with them being vulnerable and sharing things about themselves that they're maybe uncomfortable sharing to show the way. And, you know, I come back to trust because we look at the book, Patrick Lencioni's book, The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. It's a fairly well-known book. Mm. And he has a pyramid about the dysfunctions of a team. And the bottom of the pyramid is trust. Mm-hmm. So like that's his whole, like you can't start. And then, you know, and then there's being accountable to each other. But his point is you can't be accountable to each other if you don't trust each other. Because you know, being accountable means saying when you did and didn't do things. And you're not going to be open to that if you don't trust the other person to hold, you know, to respect you when you're failing.
Yeah, it's at the foundation of everything.
Mm. Right. You know, it's also like in my facilitation, I don't allow any personal attacks. Like sometimes you see in teams, there's a lot of, and sometimes it's kind of bro, brother kind of thing. Right. And they're really disguised sarcastic attacks on each other.
Mm.
Right. And so you can say, I think that's a terrible idea. You can't say you're a terrible person for having that idea.
Mm.
Now, people rarely say it so explicitly, but they often have language that implies that.
Implicitly,
right? Implicitly. And I catch that. Like, if I see it, I call it out, like in a session. No, that's not allowed here. Right? You can totally disagree. I'm all for disagreement. Right? Mm. I mean, that if you're going to put the smartest people in the room, I don't want them saying yes to each other. I want them to really having serious debate about the ideas and where they're going and what's happening. But not about making it so you can have a very vigorous disagreement about the interpretation of the facts or where you think things are going or what's happening. But it doesn't make either of you wrong or bad.
Exactly.
It's so just you have different perspectives on the same event or the same data or, you know, and sometimes I do that too. Like, that's an interesting story. What's the data behind that?
Yeah, that's as the cut through often, isn't it? That's the cut through on.
Show me your financial statements and show me where that's changing, or show me the spreadsheet that demonstrates what you just said.
Yeah, the magic of numbers.
Oh, we don't have that. Okay, well then you just think it's just something you think, and I'm all for trusting intuition, but at some point, again, it gets back to running the business on the data. You can't just think it. You have to go build a model and go fill it in and go find the data. And sometimes in a quarter, all you can do is set a goal to go start tracking the data and putting the data in. And then you can start making some decisions about it. And often, of course, what happens is you go for a quarter and you get the data, and then it tells a totally different story and not the one you thought.
yeah, of course. But then that's also then once again the good thing about the data is that it doesn't really lie usually, you know, unless of course the data is wrong.
Well, there's still a lot of room in business for interpretation. Business is way more art than science, although people may think otherwise, right? But
certainly.
It's like when I am coaching people around financial statements and understanding financial statements, it's like, it's not about the number.
Mm.
It's about what the number means to your business.
Mm.
Like I was in a recent facilitation, we were going through, they did some great improvements in some of their production. And I said, great, who will pay you 10% more now that you're this much better at this?
Mm.
No one can answer that. Like, yes, you've improved the process, and yes, it's better. Or how will you generate 10% more profit by being this much more efficient with the process?
Sure. So,
because they were hyper focused on the process and the outcome of the process, and not hyper focused on the business result, more sales, lower costs, higher profits that could result from this.
Yeah, I guess that's that can also be like a very exciting part too, especially when people feel that they've nailed something. Yeah, and that's got its own merits then too. But you're right. I mean, it's coming back to earth and finding out how that's going to actually relate. And then once again, comes back to relatability, but in a different way, you know, the same sort of thing. So how do you, you talk as well about X factor in the business too. Can you sort of expand on that a little bit, I guess, David, and where or if the role of the entrepreneur in the business, the importance that they have in the business relates to that X factor and how important that is for a business?
So let me preface this a little bit. So that concept of the X factor, I think is maybe described best. So I work a lot with this guy, Vern Harnish. He's written two books, The Rockefeller Habits and Scaling Up. And part of his work is he's come up with this one-page strategic plan. And this is the template that I use for my work with clients. And a lot of entrepreneurs who believe in it because, you know, a strategy binder that's 3 inches thick is useless. If you can get everything that's important about your business on a single piece of paper, then I think you got a chance. So when we talk about an X factor, we really talk about marketing. And my belief is that the number one thing that a CEO should be focused on is marketing. Like, marketing equals strategy. And I mean strategic. I don't necessarily mean the block and tackle and, you know, Marcom and branding and logos. I mean strategic marketing. Who's your ideal customer? You know, where are they located? What's their role? How do you attract leads for them in the lowest cost possible way? And so what I've seen, like, for example, in software, so I've done a lot of like high-end software sales. Like, if your solution is, say, 4 times better than the entrenched competitor, no one will give you the time of day, because everyone knows, like, the cost and disruption to the business of disrupting a major business process with a new piece of software. Like, if it's only 4 times better, why bother? Like, like 1/4 of the cost. Like, it's unproven. You don't know if it'll work for sure. So that's where we kind of get, that's where we get 10X. Like, how can you be 10 times better than your competitors at some aspect of your industry? And I also caution people, we tend to get really focused on kind of product features and, like, you know, product specific things. And I think, like, Vern used this example from 25 years ago, was actually an Australian based, I don't remember which city they were based in, lawn care company. And at the time in the lawn care industry, like, to do a quote, you know, a person picked up the phone and called. It was the old days, right? You didn't go to a website, fill out a form. You actually called a human. But you went and you booked an appointment for a salesperson to come out to your property, and they would have like a rolling tape measure, and they would go around your property and they'd measure it. And then they go back to the office and they would figure out how many square footage you had. And then they would send you a quote, right? And the whole process took like 2-3 weeks.
Yep.
So their innovation, their X factor was, that was a time when aerial, photography, like accurate aerial photography, was being generated by the municipality. And they could go online and they could approximate. I mean, it wasn't perfect, but they could approximate what, how much lawn there was by looking at these aerial photographs. And they could provide a quote over the telephone while the person was on the phone.
Right.
And it wasn't 100% accurate, but, you know, when it was averaged, some people maybe got charged a little under and some a little over, but, like, the variance was small enough, it wasn't going to, like, lose customers. And that was their X factor. Their X factor was they could quote instantly instead of, like, in a 3-week turnaround. And that made them hugely successful.
A big now, edge over their competitors.
Did they cut lawns better than other people? Probably, you know, I mean, they probably were good. But it's not like they were 10 times better at cutting lawns. What they were 10 times better at was quoting and getting the customer on board. And so this is where I challenge entrepreneurs to, like, it, look at their industry. Another one is a local alarm company here in Vancouver. And the alarm business has a dirty secret. And that dirty secret is, if an alarm goes off, nothing happens. Like, what happens is usually there's some huge, massive call center that says, oh, there's an alarm going off at Mr. Greer's place. I'll call him. Hello, Mr. Greer. I see that an alarm is going off at your place. And meanwhile, I'm like I was in, you know, I'm based in Vancouver. My house is in Vancouver. And last week I was in Toronto. So receiving a call from the alarm company that my alarm is going off is of absolutely no use to me. And so Mike Yeager, who I feature in my book, he founded an alarm company on the brand promise, 5 minutes to your door, your money back. And, like, that's, it's bigger than 10, because it's like breaking the entire secret of the industry, which is, oh, there's actually someone who's going to come to your door and, like, shine a flashlight and, like, see if any windows are broken or doors or.
Yeah, what you would expect usually.
And in fact, they actually have a key to every house. So they also like alarm for, you know, if a water, if there's water leakage.
Sure.
And other things. And we had friends of ours, you know, 10 or more years ago who had a small leak in the feed to their toilet and it ran nonstop for 3 days and, it caused over $500,000 of damage.
Mm.
Right. So, by the way, now whenever we leave the house, like when we went to Toronto last week, we turn off the valves to the feed to all the toilets, based on that experience. But again, like this Provident Security, and it's, they have a very interesting way how they track the keys so they can do it, in a way that people don't know whose key is whose, so that like a security person can't use the key to break in.
Right.
That turns out to be part of their secret sauce as well. But someone can actually go into the house and check like that everything is okay and that nothing seems to be disturbed. And so again, like this is like breaking an industry norm that no one likes to talk about.
Mm.
So that's the kind of things I encourage people to think about. Like, how can you disrupt a whole industry by doing something different? It's a very creative process. It's very strategic, right?
As a big element of trust, well, in that particular circumstance too, but I guess in a lot of things like this, it gets back to trust again, doesn't it? Yeah. Well, especially there, because like people then, in order for that to work, you know, in any event, there has to be a huge amount of trust, which in turn means that they have to have procedures to be able to kind of instill that trust, like yes. You were talking about with those keys, because otherwise that trust potentially could erode, even if nothing happens. But the question is there, you know, and there's probably a number of applications to different industries with similar sorts of things that I'm sure you would.
So if any listeners are curious, I really suggest they buy my book, because I articulate in the book how Mike handles the key problem. And it's a very interesting solution.
Right.
And essentially no guard can, I mean, every guard in their car has every key to every house that they monitor. But they're all in numbered envelopes, and the guard has no idea which envelope has the key to the house, to a house in question. He has to call back to the office. And the office says, go to envelope 4578284. And that will be the key to the house.
Right.
But then here's the trick is, one of their key productivity indicators is the number of opened envelopes. Like essentially once an envelope is opened, it has to be returned to the office and a new envelope with a different number must be issued.
Right. Interesting. That's good. That's smart.
It's very smart. Mike is a really smart guy. So
that's great. But it's great then for people. Cause is it true that customers then know that is the procedure to sort of instill that trust? They know how that works.
I've never gone in enough depth with Mike to like, I'm sure that his salespeople need to create trust from their prospects. You know, do they describe the process to build trust? I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of their business is just referral.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, sure.
And,
yeah, because some people want to know, like you would know, like some people want to know and
lots wouldn't care.
More untrustworthy. Yeah, yeah, and lots wouldn't care. They're just like, great, awesome. It's all right. Done. Yeah.
I've seen your cars all over, and he also is brilliant at branding. The colors he uses in every single security car for Provident Security, you know it when you see it in the neighborhood.
Mm.
And the brand promise is plastered right on the side.
Yeah. No, interesting. So that's just moving on just to another question there too, between habits and goals, because we've been talking about, you know, goal setting and quarterly and then weekly and various things too. But what's the difference, explaining it for people listening from your perspective, between habits and goals? Like, how do you define those two things?
Well, goals is a place that you are trying to get to.
Mm-hmm.
A habit is a process that you execute on a regular basis. So, for example, a big part of the Rockefeller habits, which is what this one-page plan and the stuff from Vern Harnish is called, is meeting rhythm. And so, for example, I said that part of the meeting rhythm is to meet offsite once a quarter to review your plan, look at the biggest challenge you have in front of you, and come up with a new plan for the quarter. So that's the habit. The habit is once a quarter we get offsite and we meet. Another one is highly recommended in the Rockefeller habits is that the entrepreneur meets with his or her senior leadership team once a week. And there's a very prescribed like 60 minute agenda as to what you start with some wins and or a core value that someone demonstrated. Then you debate and discuss like where you are, what worked last week, what didn't, where you're stuck. And then the last half hour is filling out who, what, when, who is going to do what by when, either in, a tool like Notion, or I have a spreadsheet template that I share with people. In my experience, like high performing businesses get really good at who, what, when, and they adopt it. And so the habit is meeting weekly to debate and set your who, what, when for the next week. And good and high growth companies that perform really well, they regularly execute their who, what, when. So they actually do get done what they say they are going to do.
Mm. Yeah, right. I think that seems like that particular point seems like the sort of almost like the secret sauce that if you don't, that's easy to say, but then is the thing that a lot of people don't do, because then it's easy not to do seemingly little things, little sort of like in a habit. So that'd be right. You see that a lot, right?
Well, and it's also the trust and the accountability issue.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. Like, again, you have to trust each other that you're, putting the right things down, but then also you have to be willing to be accountable when you don't deliver and not, and if someone's not delivering on a regular basis and it's always excuses, like, I'm sorry, high performing teams deliver, like high performing businesses. Like if you said to your customers, I'm going to deliver our product. If you were 50% of the time you didn't deliver to your customer when you said you would, how long would you stay in business?
Mm.
Very, very short period of time.
Mm.
So it's the same with leadership teams. If you say you're going to do this and only 50% of the time you do what you say you're going to do, like why would employees ever believe you?
Mm.
Like why do you believe each other? Like high performing teams set goals and do the goals, set the goals, do the goals. That's the definition of high performance.
Mm. Yeah. Once again, returns to trust again, doesn't it?
Trust, accountability.
Yeah. Trust.
Clarity of goals. A lot of people don't set clear goals.
Mm.
Some of my work in facilitation is when people are coming up with their goals for the quarter, it's like when we meet 13 weeks from now, how will we absolutely know that you passed the finish line? Because they'll be very, it's like, well, we're going to improve customer service. Great. How do you measure customer service today? Oh, yeah. We don't. Okay. Well, then maybe a reasonable goal for the next quarter is that you put a system in place to measure customer service and that you have measured it at least once. And that's the finish line. Like either you put a system in place and you measured it at least once or you did not. Then like in the next quarter, we could say, well, the next quarter might be just gather like a minimum of X, customer surveys or whatever process that you come up with. It's like, do that process at least 1,000 times in the next quarter. And then when you meet the quarter after, then now you can talk about, okay, this is what we learned. This is like our average response time. This is like how accurate we are. And then maybe you take one of those numbers and move them from X to Y. But remember, a couple quarters ago, people were saying we want to improve customer service. Well, look at what you had to put a lot in place so that you even had a hope of being able to do it. It's not a finish line, is my point, right?
Yeah.
It's a dream. It's a intention. It's not a goal.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And then the process is where would you say, like, in the scale of, yeah, if there's a proper answer to this, I'm not sure, but in terms of the level of importance between reaching the goal and the process to get to the goal, you know, is there any one of those two things that's more important when you're, you know, the
actual over time you've got to set and meet your goals. Otherwise you're like, what's the point? Like you're
right.
What's the point of getting off site and meeting? Right. Now, sometimes the spectacular failures are where like the biggest learnings are.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So I'm not saying it never happens. And you definitely, if you're not meeting your goals, like you want to really explore that, like, cause we're not setting the right goals, because we're not staying focused on it. Because we didn't put enough effort into it. Were they too big? Yeah. So like, yeah, I still help them dissect those and look at, like, part of every strategic planning session is that I facilitate. I look at the last quarter's goals and I like do a percentage, like what percentage of it, like, did you do? And sometimes it's like we got a halfway through the quarter and we realized that based on new data that we got and new information, like, you know, the company we were going to get, we were looking at acquiring, it got acquired by someone else.
Mm.
So like, it wasn't so, it made no sense to go focus anymore on the goal.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course.
Like, you know, if there is really big new data, yes, that can be understandable, but it's rarely that happens. Rarely that happens. It's much more a breakdown in not choosing the right goals, not staying focused on them. Someone that's accountable who isn't accountable. And in the Vern Harnish stuff, we separate accountability from doing. Like sometimes it's actually helpful to have a senior member of the leadership team take on the accountability part for a goal that they're not involved with, especially if like a couple other people on the senior leadership team are heavily, heavily involved in the goal and are kind of don't agree on a lot of things. You know, and again, the accountability person is to check in with those individuals every week, get a gauge of where they are on achieving the goal and report at the weekly team meeting. Like the weekly team meeting, you should be reviewing each of your goals for the quarter and your progress and how close you are to achieving your progress. That's also why I never allow more than 4-5 max goals for a quarter. People set way too many goals rather than too few. And it's brutal to set few goals, but it's about focus. Like if you don't focus, you just spin your wheels and, you know, it's like putting 10 people into a boat with oars and like they all pull in the oars and there's a lot of splashing and there's a lot of action and the boat just sits there going in circles.
Mm. Yeah, right. That uniform way moving forward, I guess, isn't it? Yeah, in time.
It's creating alignment. It's creating alignment between the entrepreneur, the senior leadership team, and then equally important between the senior leadership team and like all the way down the command and control. Like I facilitate, maybe not at the moment, but you know, for up to 150, 200 employees. Like, how does the person who's running the warehouse, how do they relate to the goals that we just set? Because if they don't relate to them, then have we even got the right goals?
Mm.
Like, maybe they can't relate to all 5 for the quarter, but there better be a couple where they see their part in making this happen.
Mm.
And there almost always is a part. It's just you have to really think it through from that person's point of view.
Mm.
Right. But I mean, everyone needs to be aligned. Again, that idea of everyone is pulling on an oar, or Jim Collins says it's better. It's about pushing on a flywheel in the same direction.
Mm.
And is it the 100th push that gets it moving? Is it the 1,000th push? Is it the 50,000th push? Usually you don't know.
Mm.
But if everyone just doesn't keep pushing on that flywheel in the same direction, in the same direction, in the same direction, as best they can with the effort that they can put into it, like it won't come free and it won't start spinning.
Mm, yeah, we're moving in the right way. We were, my son and I were talking last night about, we do a little bit of military strategy sort of interests and various things like that. And we were talking about people marching. So say Napoleonic sort of eras when people used to march forward. And we were talking about the fact that it's things like that are actually a lot like the drilling, you know, that people being in sync and having a leader and marching forward, which when you look at it just at first glance, it looks really easy. You know, it looks like there's this group of people marching forward. And it was actually the first time, it was really funny because it was the first time I'd actually thought about it like this before. I was like, yeah, it looks pretty easy. They're all like moving forward in time. And then we were thinking about it and to actually do that. And we did a little test ourselves of just doing it at the same time, even with two people. We're like, it's surprisingly difficult, you know, to actually do that. And I was thinking some of it has to do with the obvious use of drumming, of music, of sound. Some of it is just practice. Some of it is the orders from the person who's in charge. And then some of it is because people can't really look sideways and make sure that they're actually in line. They have to use their side vision, you know, then there's sound and there's all these things. So I was like, it's actually kind of complicated. And when, you know, I thought it was a great example when we were just talking then about, you know, a group of people, once again, that sort of metaphor of doing things enough times for a particular purpose and being willing to do it and having a purpose to do it and then doing it lots of times until the person looking over the other side of the hill, you know, or the person, you know, looking at it on TV going, wow, that kind of looks amazing. They're all in sync, but not realizing how much work has gone into it.
Yeah, and you know what? When customers interact with our business, that should be their experience. Like that it's this perfectly smooth march, and they should never have to know like how much work went into making that come true. But they should have the full, our job is to put in all that work so they can have that experience.
Yeah.
So they can have a really smooth onboarding experience or really smooth ongoing experience with our products and services. And this takes a lot of time and effort and foresight and planning to pull off.
Yeah.
And most businesses are pretty bad at it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's something I remember specifically in the making of Lord of the Rings, Lord of the Rings movies, that one of their goals with the special effects was to be that it was so good that you wouldn't really be thinking, highlighting in your mind that there were special effects there, that things would be seamless and would seem like this other world, that the illusion at the end of it was it wouldn't be highlighted that that is a, you know, some creature. It was perfectly a part of the image and the story that was put forward, that you would, you know, same sort of idea. And I think it's certainly something that when it happens, like you were saying, like it's seamless and perfect and it's a great experience. But, you know, to get to that point, there's so much, you know, blood, sweat and tears, but it's always makes for a great story then too, when people actually find out, you know, that's the part that I like too. When you go, what did you have to do to make that happen? That's kind of incredible. You know,
it is incredible. In many businesses, it is absolutely incredible.
Yeah. I love hearing those parts about your realization whenever I've had them, like, you know, the marching thing, when I just had this sort of a bit of a light bulb moment. I was like, marching, you know, and especially then because it was so, you know, never thought about it before, you know, and then going, that'd be really difficult. But yeah, you know, just on a, I guess a personal note, David, in your journey then too, what are some of the things that have really helped you, like in your own entrepreneurial journey, I guess, you know, the past, in more recent times, that have really helped you get through things? Like, what are some of those things that you'd share with people that have really helped you?
Certainly for me, you know, on my 50th birthday, I hired this guy, Coach Kevin, who a few months previously had made me more uncomfortable than I had been in like a half a dozen years, like really uncomfortable. And, he saw something in me and I sent something in him. And, I mean, he had a massive impact in my life. In fact, he was the first person. We worked together for 9 years in total, but after we'd worked together for 18 months, we'd like cleared everything off of the table, except for the proverbial elephant in the room. And he was the first person I admitted I had a drinking problem to.
All right.
Which he had no idea. And he wouldn't, because, you know, I didn't drink till later on in the day and our coaching calls were always during the day. And I'm a high performer. The last thing I would ever let anyone know was that I had a drinking problem. But I admitted to him, and he coached me to go to 12-step recovery. And, you know, I feel that the universe put Kevin in my path to get me sober. And, you know, then he got me into a variety of gigs where I was helping entrepreneur friends of mine, like as a senior executive. But behind the scenes, I was always working on strategy. Till I came out of my last of that. And then I decided that I wanted to give to the gifts to other entrepreneurs, the gifts that Kevin had given to me, which I just started on my, my coaching journey. You know, so that was August 9th, 2007. So, and we're in 2024. So, you know, the last, 17, 18 years of my life, and after Kevin, he wasn't going to do one-on-one coaching anymore because he wanted to focus exclusively on strategic planning and facilitation. So he turned me over to his coach, Nan O'Connor, who I still work with. I think as entrepreneurs, you know, again, it's like trying to get sober. I think we try and do too much ourselves. And so whether you find like a peer group that you meet with once a month and, you know, or you join EO, or you find, you know, through your local chamber of commerce or other like ways to connect with other entrepreneurs or mentors. Because, you know, I've grown it by the seat of my pants and the hard way. And, you're welcome to do that. You know, I wrote my book so you don't have to wear all the scar tissue that I wore, you know, that I earned. Like, if you want to, it's like, you're welcome to it. But, you know, if you want to earn some of your own scar tissue, why don't you make it different than mine and like the 45 entrepreneurs that I interviewed for the book?
Yeah, it'll probably happen of its own accord anyway, without you having to, you know, even if you try to avoid it, like it'll happen for sure. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly I feel very much the same about like having support too. Like I go and have for whatever it is, 13 or 14 years now, networking, you know, groups. And I've always viewed, outside of the obvious, you know, leads or whatever, I've actually always very much viewed it in quite a sports sort of sense, that I've always seen it like weekly training, sort of training in a range of respects, but also a default support group. It's just like a weekly reminder that people in completely different industries that do completely different things, you know, to what I do, are actually, there's this like constant reminder every single week that there's like way more similarities to things that I'm doing than there are differences. Like, and that still kind of surprises me. I know I probably shouldn't anymore, but it still does, that I'm like, wow, people are really similar, and most people are actually really nice and actually really want to help. That's what I think anyway. Like
I think you're right.
I really think it's true, because I mean, the evidence is, you know, if you want to talk about, you know, the numbers or the evidence, that's there, because I've been doing it for this many years. And that's been my overwhelming experience. There's been like a tiny percentage, very small percentage, that haven't been like that. Admittedly, you know, people are there to do that as well. Like, you're there in that environment to do that, but even not there with clients and other people, you know, people are nice and they generally want to help. And then having people like yourself and then your coach and other people there as that support too, I think it's wonderful. And I think, like, I really like I know I said it before, but I really like your whole story as a sailor and those metaphors. I think they're even for people like it quite resonated with me for whatever reason. It just seemed like a really accurate, great way to describe particular things in business. And I haven't even been a sailor, but actually it may have helped. It may have helped actually, David, that I've been listening to these Hornblower books about, I'm not sure whether you've heard of them.
I have. I know of them.
Yeah.
They're great. I've read one or two. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's been a little bit, my son was reading them and then he sort of said he encouraged me and I was listening to them on audiobook and they're fantastic. And so I got this real flavor of navigation and the sea and like seafaring sort of life in that era, the Napoleonic era. So that probably informed me a little bit, you know, so I'm a bit more, I'm that way inclined. But, you know, as we've run through a range of different things, but have you got any other particular points that you'd really like to share with everybody listening that you feel we haven't quite sort of covered off on as yet?
I feel like, you know, I think there's more than enough here for people to digest. So I wouldn't want to introduce, you know, anything more.
Sure.
You know, it's kind of my parting thoughts is back to that model of, you know, business and life and yourself. It's like I would really challenge listeners to say, like, what have you got booked in your schedule over the next couple months, you know, for things that really renew you and build your resiliency, like things that you do just for yourself, which still might be with other people. But, you know, whether it's go ride a motorbike, you know, go on a ski trip, you know, like. It's just whatever it is that really builds your resiliency. Like, have you actually got that in your schedule? Or have you got a daily practice? I still with all of my clients, are you eating well? Did you sleep enough? Are you exercising? Sorry, folks, but like, if you're not doing those three things to look after yourself, like you're going to crash and burn probably sooner rather than later. And we just always have to go back to the basics because we all have busy lives and we all have a lot going on. And, you know, those are just three of the core resiliency things that we need to do for ourselves and make sure don't get squeezed out by other things that are going on. So, you know, if in doubt, go back to basics.
And make sure you drink plenty of water.
Well, that too.
Make sure you drink water, everyone. Yeah. Pop tip for the day is that. So, also give us a fantastic quote as well, David. Have you got one? Have you got one that you want to share with everyone?
Yeah, it's my own. Slow down. Yes. Here it is. Slow down to speed up.
Ah, yeah, nice. I like it. Nice and simple.
Yep.
And
we'd all forget. But
Very true. We'll have these links too on the podcast, but what are the best ways for people to find out more about you online, about you, but then also the book as well?
My website, CoachDJGreer.com. So that's Coach, D as in David, J as in James, Greer.com. My phone number and my email address is on every single page on my website. So you have no excuse not to contact me if you want. I do want to let listeners know that I am always open to offering 1 hour of free coaching if there's something you're really stuck on. You know, to book a call with me and we'll work through it. And I guarantee that after an hour with me, you'll have at least three ideas to accelerate your business in the next 90 days.
How do you feel about working with Australians, David?
I'm open for that, actually. The time zones are not totally crazy.
They're not too bad. Yeah.
It's harder to work with people in the UK.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's true.
From Vancouver. Yeah. I just got to keep remembering that you're like, it's Monday afternoon here, but it's Tuesday morning for you. So I always got to remember, you know, don't book a call with an Australian on Friday unless they're working on the weekend.
Yeah, you do have to. Yeah, because I've been having probably more calls and more podcasts in the UK. So they're always very nicely up later at night when I'm in the morning, because it's kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, it's 8:15 now, but sort of usually start at 7. But anyway, like, thank you so much for like sharing all those things we were discussing, David. I think it's all these sorts of topics are very valuable at any point in time for entrepreneurs and business owners and anyone listening. And it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being here, and thanks to all your listeners.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. See you later and have a great week, and say goodbye, David.
So long. Bye now.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.